Michael Strauss, who is with the Oberlin College. Good morning.
Good morning.
Viola? Viola. What is it? Craig, now you had somebody in your family, didn't your daughter?
Well, my daughter played for, I don't know, 6-7 years.
There you go.
Can still do it.
The viola.
What about your daughter?
Viola. How what size? No, it's a clarinet.
Oh,
I can pronounce clarinet. But when you get into the string instruments and the different sizes of the ones that there are, can you kind of run over a little bit of that just for a precursor for me?
I can certainly run you over.
It's going to be one of these interviews, I can say.
Oh, yeah.
No, all right. So viola is a name of a person, and viola is a name of an instrument.
I will remember that now.
Actually, it comes from the Italian word violin, which is the violin, and we pronounce viola in that pronunciation rather than the Americanized violin. You still say violin in some countries, but here in America, we're violin, but we actually say viola. So,
okay.
I don't know if that's a stanzer for you,
that's good.
But we say viola.
That's a good start.
We can go into potato, potato, tomato, tomato. Sure. I don't mind that song either.
Now, back in the day when you were a younger gent growing up, was that your first instrument of choice?
It was. I'm an original violist, and the story goes that I started in the public schools. We had a wonderful woman who came and started all of us in the third grade, not the fifth grade, not the sixth grade, but the third grade back then, on string instruments. And I didn't really want to play a string instrument. I wanted to play the saxophone, but they wouldn't let us play a saxophone until the fourth grade. So I thought, well, I'm at least I can maybe learn how to play something, and I can learn how to read music, and no one's playing this thing called the viola. I have no idea what it is, but it doesn't really matter because I just want to play the saxophone anyway. I'll take lessons and learn how to read music, since it was all the same. I didn't know what a clef was or anything like that, and turns out that I really liked the viola, and I never had any thoughts about going to the saxophone again until recently, actually. But the reeds scare me. The reeds scare me. So viola it is for me. All the way.
All the way. Since third grade.
Since third grade.
Now, what brought it into a point where you decided, I want to share this passion, I want to teach this, I want to do this in the conservatory setting?
Well, I had wonderful teachers growing up and mentors. And they were the ones that instilled a love of teaching in me. Until recently, I've been mostly a performer. I've always seemingly had. I started my first appointment at a conservatory was when I was still in a conservatory. I was at Curtis Institute in Philadelphia, and there was a need for a viola teacher at the Philadelphia College of the Performing Arts, which. Had a wonderful music school back in the day. They joined with the Temple University, a few years after I left Philadelphia. But I started teaching there, and then I was quickly appointed at Swarthmore College, and I was still, actually at the time, still a student when I was teaching. And I tell this to some of my students, they don't quite believe me, but because this is an all undergraduate institution, but these other places had masters and master's degrees and performance degrees that were post-grad, and I was in some cases teaching students that were older than I was, which was very interesting. But I got a lot of experience there, and wherever I went in my professional life, I always seemed to be teaching somewhere, and I loved it, and I love it. I love guiding the next generation, and all the challenges we face for basically our culture and the arts in the United States and in the world going forward, and just try to guide them to find their path and their niche. It's a really It's a great avocation. It's a great thing to do with your life, and I love my students.
We often hear stories. We talk about this on the air every now and then. There are different kinds of auctions or whatever. We often hear about very old, valuable violins.
Mm-hmm.
Does it apply for violas as well?
Oh, yes. Yes, in fact, when there was a quartet of Stradivarius sold, maybe 15, 20 years ago, they broke it down that the Strad violins and the cellos were all something like $1 million a piece, and the viola was $8 million. I don't know how they came to that kind of that breakdown, but it kind of made the viola world chuckle a little bit when that happened. But yeah, violas are even older than violins. You can find violas that are it was a more modern instrument, quote unquote, than the violin was when violins started appearing in the mid 16th century. It was around the same time that violas were appearing, but violas, or an arm viol, is what they really were. The gambas and those kinds of viols that you held between your legs were even predating arm viols. But violas were appearing in the early 16th century, and you know, just as an antiquity itself, it's a very prized possession. But my viola is from 1704. It's a very beautiful instrument, and it's just the historical value alone is quite high. But violas can fetch a very high price.
How do you care for that to keep it in top shape?
Well, I have a shop that I care for. They care for me. Have a long relationship with them, and I usually give the viola to them for a week once a year, and they check it out and make sure that everything's fine, and they clean it up a little bit and ungooify it, as it were, because you know there's a lot of things that happen on a viola when you're performing on it. As you can imagine, it's you know constantly up around your face and your neck, and so there's sweat issues, there are oils. There's just straight pressure issues and tension issues that make the instrument do certain things. They'll open up at the seams, which isn't a big deal, but it sounds bad. But it's just a simple re-gluing process and clamping. The fingerboard where we place our fingers often gets misshapen or worn in a certain way. So there's a sanding process that they do with the ebony fingerboard that can refresh it. The bridge, which holds the strings up on top of the instrument, can get out of place. There's a bar inside the instrument that's called the sound post that gives the instrument a certain kind of tension at all times. That moves around. That needs to get repositioned. It's like tuning up a car or anything else, but you know, it's very specific to the instrument. And my instrument hasn't had a huge amount of repairs done to it over the 300 years that it's been with us on this planet, but there are a few repairs on it through the years, and those need to be checked out to make sure that they're holding and that they're glued and everything's fine. And it's a general maintenance thing.
Do an instrument that old have some sort of a title in regards to where it's been, mm-hmm. what its history is like?
Yeah, it depends on who it's been with. My particular instrument, it's made by a maker named Albani. It's an Italian name. His name was actually Matthias Alban. He was German, and he moved to Italy along with his huge workshop. For marketing reasons, and that instrument, you know, it passed through a few hands, but it was actually kind of a local instrument in the fact that it was in the hands of the principal violist for the Detroit Symphony in the early part of the 20th century, and his name was Blumenau. So this instrument has it's the Blumenau Albani. It's had several owners since then. Used to be in Robert Cort's hands at the University of Michigan, who was in the Paganini string quartet. And it's a fun instrument to have. It definitely does have a mind of its own in certain respects.
Okay, well, as he says this and I see a ghost next to him because it's Halloween, I'm thinking a little possession maybe.
Yes.
With any instrument, maybe there is a little history that you can sort of feel within it as well.
Sure.
But it's very interesting that...
Well, and I instruct my students as well that when they get usually they have newer instruments, usually. And in fact, I have two students who have brand new instruments right now. They just hot off the presses, and they're proud owners of new instruments. And I tell them that they are giving them their first breath of life. You know, you have to be very careful not careful as in worried about playing it, but you need to be especially cognitive of the sounds that you are generating with the instruments, because the instruments they do have memories.
Okay. Yeah, that's fascinating. You think about that, and probably there's more sense of when you play your own instrument as opposed to someone else's. There's a maybe a different sort of. It's like trying someone else's car. It's all set up a little differently, I suppose.
Oh, I think people who are sensitive to their cars would say the same thing. That when someone else drives their car, it takes a little time for it to feel like theirs again. And it's true with my instrument. I'm perfectly fine with having anyone try it, but there's always a readjustment period when it comes back into my hands. It's pretty funny.
That's great. Our guest today has been Michael Strauss, associate professor of
Viola
and chamber music over at Oberlin College.
Viola and chamber music.
And chamber music.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is a great way that those instruments get to be performed.
That's true.
As well. But we appreciate your time this morning. Running a little late this morning as we continue on.